Hello, welcome to your meditation practice as part of the Open Heart Project. My name is Susan Piver. I'm very happy to sit with you in meditation. We're going to sit together today for 10 minutes, and we're going to start soon-ish. So please take your seat, get settled, whether you're on a cushion on the floor with your legs crossed loosely in front of you, or you could kneel, that's also fine. Or you can sit in a chair or on the sofa, that is also fine, and equally as spiritual. As I'm very fond of saying, as sitting on the floor. So before we sit, I want to continue in the vein that we started in. I don't know if that's good English. In the beginning of the year, which was just a few weeks ago, in the first video that I made, and nobody has to go back and watch anything if they don't want, I said I want the videos this year in 2024 to be personal. Meaning about you personally, about how our practice has consequence in your personal life, not just, you know, we read books about it or people said this is what's going to happen, but just what does this mean to you personally to be on the path, to have a meditation practice, whatever it may be, whatever it may look like is fine. How do these teachings, these 2,500 plus year old teachings of the Buddha Dharma, not what do they mean, but what do they mean to you? What do they mean to me? That's where it all comes alive. And I know that for many of us, and I put myself in this group as well, the main focus that we have on whatever we bring into our life is, am I good enough to do this? Am I good at it? I might mess it up. I probably don't know what I'm doing. I want to be good at it. And okay, great. I want to be good at it too. Whatever it is, I want to be good at whatever it is I try and all those things. But this is not about being good at anything. Meditation practice, I mean, the spiritual journey has nothing to do with being good at it. How could you be good at my spiritual journey? How could I be good even at the spiritual journey that the Buddha took? It has to be personal in order for it to be good, meaning meaningful, powerful. So in a poem written by Rumi, the 14th, I think, century Sufi poet, he has a bit that says, out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. I meet you there right now. This practice takes place in that field beyond right and wrong. So as long as you try, you know, and do the technique, which we're going to do shortly, there's no way you can do it wrong. And there's no way you can do it right. So please enjoy being confounded by that notion. You can't do it right. You can't do it wrong. So now what? So in keeping with the spirit, the personal nature of these conversations, because I feel like they're conversations, even though I'm sitting here by myself right now, I wanted to answer a question that I hear from you guys from time to time, which is, how did you start doing this, Suzy Piver? How did you start? Or what was your journey? What's your story? And so I'm going to tell you right now, and if you're not interested or you don't have time, I salute you. You can jump forward to when the meditation starts. The time code will be somewhere in this email or on this page. So I thought I would get the personal ball rolling. So anyway, enough with the caveats. I've been a practitioner for more than 30 years. I started practicing meditation in 1993. And shortly after that, I took refuge. I don't know why I'm going like this. I formally became a Buddhist. Nobody has to do that. But I knew that that was the right thing for me. I knew it. And I have not had any argument with myself about that knowing since that time. So I was lucky, made sense. I did it. It still makes sense. Why did I start meditating? I'm asking myself questions that I will answer. So throwing it way, way back, like maybe 35 years ago. I was in a very bad accident. Some of you probably know this. I wrote about it in different thing, books and so forth. I was, and when I say really bad, I mean really bad. I was in a 67 Beetle, and I was T-boned, and I was thrown out of the car and flew apparently 30 yards down the road and landed on some grass, which was the lucky part. I was hit by a Buick, so it was, you know, no contest here, a drunk driver. I was just sitting there, not minding my own business, basically. And the only things I know about this accident are things I read in the police report and the hospital report and so on, because I don't have any memory of it, zero. So that's a strange thing right there. Life-changing thing happened. They could have told me I was, you know, airlifted in by UFO or something. I wouldn't. Oh, okay. It's a strange feeling. But anyway, I had internal damage, very bad. That's what was the life-threatening part. And all these broken bones. And if you look at me right now, you can see the result. Look at my shoulders and my torso. Everything goes like this. It should be like this, but I can't do that. So now decades of this, you know, there's pain and so forth. Anyway, that's not the point of the story. Anyway, a lot of broken bones, ribs, all that, pelvis. So I get out of the hospital after some months, and it was suggested that I try yoga. And this was like 1990 or something, where yoga was like, I don't know, that might be a cult. So I went to a yoga ashram, as it was back then, and brought a book with me called The Heart of the Buddha by someone named Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. I'd never heard of this person. I didn't know what was the first name, what was the last name. I don't know. I didn't know there was difference, I realized, between Buddhism and Hinduism. I just liked the word heart. I liked that it said the heart of the Buddha, not the life of the Buddha or the teachings of the Buddha. The heart. Oh, well, what's in there? What's in that heart? I would really like to know. So I read the book, and at one point in my recollection, because I've gone back and searched for this passage many, many times and have never found it, nonetheless, I have a recollection of reading a passage in The Heart of the Buddha that has self-erased, apparently, from the book itself. The only possible spiritual journey is your personal experience. Just what I'm talking to you about right now. Exactly what I'm talking to you about. Your life is the practice. What else could it be? Your experience, your reactions, the way you think, your feelings. That's your practice. Not some belief system that someone said, this is what you should do and who you should be. And I was stunned by that. Wait, what? Me? I'm the practice? And then I realized that all my life, I had never done things by the book. I had never trusted conventional wisdom for whatever reason. And so when I read that passage, which I swear was there when I first read it, I was like, oh my God, that makes sense. Yeah. Everything, instinct I've had, you figure it out. You trust yourself. I don't know how, but do it anyway. That's what this guy's saying. That's your practice. And I was like, nobody ever said that to me before. And I remember thinking, I must be a Buddhist. I didn't know that's what it was called. Okay, close the book, go back to my life, put the book on a shelf, never thought about it again. For some years, anyway. And by the way, in my near-death experience, I didn't like see the light or none of that. I didn't have anything like that. But it was a very mysterious, nobody expected me to live type moment for a long time, weeks. It was like, she's going to go any minute. Anyway, here I am. And fast forward a few years, and I am still occasionally reading books about Buddhism. And I noticed that in every book I really liked, there was a bookmark in there, the same bookmark, like whoever the publisher was, they had a bookmark and they put it in there. And I'm like, I was living in Boston at the time. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is one publisher. They must be the most wonderful people in the world because they're publishing the best books I've ever read. And they must be in some far off exotic locale. Turns out they were down the street in Boston. So by various mechanisms, I found a way to meet them. I made up silly excuses to go talk to them. Anyway, not about me, but about their business. And I became friends with the person who was their head of sales and marketing at the time. I was in the music business at the time as a head of sales and marketing for a record company. Anyway, those details don't matter. And we're talking, we're going out to lunches, we're enjoying each other's company, chit-chat. And at one point in one of our noisy lunches, in a noisy restaurant, I said, unbeknownst to myself that I was going to say this, I think I might like to learn to meditate. And it was like all the noise dropped in the room. This is obviously my recollection, which is not really the case, but it felt that way. And this person looks at me and says, what kind? And I'm like, uh-oh, I didn't know there were different kinds. And so, hand to God, goddess, all the creatures, whatever, I said, Tibetan? Kind of like that. And he said, oh, I know someone who might be willing to teach you. Oh, that's so nice. That's great. I'd love that. He calls me some time later, goes, that person doesn't have time to teach you, but we're having a big party at our publishing house, Shambhala Publications. Why don't you come? So, okay, I'm like, oh, partying with the Shambhalians. I go, I meet the person who was did not have time to teach me how to meditate. And he says, well, I'm going away for a month, but if you still want to learn when I'm back, let me get in touch and I'll teach you how to meditate. So I'm like, yeah, I'm going to get in touch with you, buddy. So I do. And I go to his house, actually his apartment. I'm like, oh, this is weird. Some dude, me, apartment. I don't know. Unbelievably great. His name is Sam. He was the founder of Shambhala Publications, the publisher of Shambhala Publications. He published that book, The Heart of the Buddha. He was a close student at that time of Chögyam Trungpa. He published that book that I read and said, I must be a Buddhist. And now, you know, 5 years later or some years later, he's teaching me how to meditate. He is still my meditation instructor. He is still my meditation teacher. So that was a momentous experience and remains such. The last piece I'll mention is that he lived in the Boston area, would have Tuesday night meditation at his house, and there'd be maybe 10 of us would go regularly. And in one of these early evenings, there was a great teacher there named Tulku Tundup Rinpoche, who is Tibetan, was Tibetan. He just died about 3 weeks ago. And he happened to live in Cambridge. And here he is. The picture's probably 30 years old. Thank you. So I met Tulku Tundup, and he really became my root teacher. Every time I had a question about my practice, and not every time, but often, Sam, and I'd talk about it with Sam, he'd say, why don't you ask Tulku Tundup? Can I do that? So I would get in touch with him, and he would say, okay, come over at this time. And it would just be me and him in his little living room. Sometimes his wonderful, wonderful, beautiful, excellent wife, Lydia, was there. But you know, in the, somewhere. And he would give me tea, and there's always usually a little dish of almonds. And I would ask him my question, whatever it was. And he would answer me in some way that I never could understand. But I was mesmerized nonetheless. And when I was in that accident, by the way, I got hepatitis C from blood transfusions. So I did treatment. I was very, I'm fine. I don't have it anymore, but I did a long, arduous treatment for it 15 years ago or something. And it was 2 years and it was hard. And so when I was sick and I wanted medicine Buddha practice, because that's a particular practice, I asked him and he taught me how to do medicine Buddha practice. And I brought him a medicine Buddha that I had, and he held it in his hands and he blessed it and he gave it back to me. And I had it on my shrine for several years during this treatment. And P.S., the very last appointment I had with my doctor, which you have to hold for 6 months without relapsing in order to be declared cured, and I did. And at the last appointment with my gastroenterologist who told me, "You're cured," I brought the medicine Buddha and I gave it to him. So with the hope that other people could benefit. Anyway, then when my father was dying, he helped me. I talked to him about that. When I had questions about my own practice, what does this mean? What does that mean? How should I do this? I would ask him. He was such a great teacher that for 15 or so years, I didn't even realize he was my teacher. It just seemed like, oh yeah, I'll go ask Tolku Tundup. But then when I reflect back, I'm like, oh, all along he has been the teacher in my life. How lucky. How incredibly lucky. Ridiculously lucky. And the last piece I'll say, and then we will go to our practice, is at one point in a conversation with Sam, he said, "Why don't you ask Tolku Tundup?" And this was several years ago, maybe 5 years ago. And he said, "But a piece of advice, don't leave until he indicates that the conversation is over." Okay. Because I would be like, oh, an hour's gone by and I don't want to take up too much of his time. So I would be like, thank you. Also, in conversations with Tolku Tundup, there was a lot of silence, like 5 minutes, 10 minutes. You're sitting there for long stretches. And I would interpret that as, well, I guess I'm done. I guess he's got, I don't know. I would say, yeah, okay, well, thank you. Really appreciate your time and I'll be going now. But subsequent to that advice from Sam, I didn't do that. I just sat there with him in the silences. And then occasionally he would say something else, or he would ask, or then he would be like, how's your writing going? You know, he would ask me something about me. Chit chat, silence. Anyway, those silences were the teaching. I see now everything he said too, but anyway, to be in the presence of someone that is realized, as they say, they're few and far between, but they're out there. It doesn't look like anything you think it's going to look like. And the best teaching is to be in their presence. That's all I got. Anyway, so that's my story, I guess. And it was one auspicious coincidence after the other and remains so. And my approach now to my own practice and my own life is get out of the way. Just get out of the way. It's happening. I don't know what it is, but how can I get out of the way? Not diminishing or like, oh, you suck or anything like that. Just how can I put my attention on what is really important, which is the journey, not my thoughts about the journey. So there you go. What is your story? I would love to hear. You can put in comments. You can make a little video like this. Give me the link. I would love to know. I'd love to know. So, thank you for listening. Establish your posture, please, from the ground up. The legs are crossed loosely in front, or your feet can be flat on the floor. The hands rest on the legs, palms down. And really just let the hands relax. This is actually a mudra called Resting the Mind Mudra. And that's what we're doing right now, resting our minds. You can feel heavy from the waist down and light from the waist up. Rooted and aspiring. At the same time, you're just sitting there doing nothing, so no big deal. Sit up straight and let the front body soften. The belly, the area around the heart, your throat. The chin is tucked a little bit, so the back of the neck is long. The mouth is closed, but the lips and teeth are slightly parted, unless that's uncomfortable. The breath is natural in and out through the nose, meaning no breathing technique, just breathing, whatever you were doing before I said breathing, just keep doing that. The eyes are open so we can see our lives and our world and make it all part of the path. The gaze is soft and cast down to a comfortable spot in front. Let the brow relax. Let the attention come to rest on the feeling of the body breathing. Feel the inhale and the exhale. And let there be a sense of your mind resting on the wave of breath, letting it be carried by the breath. Your mind will continue to make thoughts, and that's no big deal. Thoughts come and go. Let them be in the background while your breath is in the foreground to the best of your ability. And if you notice that you become absorbed in thought to the point where you have forgotten about your breath entirely, excellent. Notice that. Label that thinking. And then just let go. That's the fun part. Don't skip that. Just let go, whether the thought is horrible or beautiful or boring. Doesn't matter right now. Just let go. Bring your attention back to the feeling of the body breathing. And begin again. So we'll sit together in silence until you hear the bell. Thank you so much for your practice. Thank you for practicing with me. And thank you for practicing together. I'll see you next week. Thank you. That's it.
Can I kiss the teacher?
Yeah. Let me turn off recording.